Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Welcome to this special edition of Listen to Older Voices. I'm Rob Greaves. This is part two of a three-part program that tells the story of the shootout between the police and the Kelly Gang at Stringy Bark Creek 132 years ago, in October 1878. One policeman, Trooper Thomas McIntyre, survived to tell the story in a journal he subsequently wrote. The McIntyre family eventually gave the journal and other mementos to the Victorian Police, and in return were given two copies of that journal. One copy ended up with the great-grandson of McIntyre, 66-year-old Laurie Hookey. I visited Laurie and his wife Mary Rose in their home in Hillsville, where we discussed the murder of the three police at Stringy Bark Creek and the subsequent events leading up to the death of the gang at Glen Rowan. We referred regularly to the McIntyre document, and Laurie was also able to call upon anecdotes passed down through the family. We finished last week having learned there was growing tension between the police and the Kellys, some of it due to the illegal activity of the Kellys, some of it to the unfortunate approach by some of the police. At Stringy Bark Creek, the police formed a camp, and two went off looking for the Kellys, and two remained. The two ambushed were Lonigan and McIntyre. Lonigan was killed by a lucky shot, or rather an unlucky shot, with Ned shooting the fatal shot. McIntyre was captured. When the other two police returned to the camp, Kennedy and Scanlon, the Kellys attempted to have them surrender, but they ambushed them instead and killed them both. During the confusion, McIntyre escaped on horseback and raised the alarm. We pick up this week looking at why it was reported that McIntyre taking Kennedy's horse was an evil deed. I found it very interesting that in your grandfather's story, he says that him taking Kennedy's horse to escape was said to be by some as an evil deed. Why would people have thought it was an evil deed that he took Kennedy's horse?
Well, I think they imagined that he'd left Kennedy in an inhumane position and he'd just bolted. But I don't know, when you look at it, you get to that stage, you've seen three of your colleagues shot by this time, two of them dead. I don't know if you're thinking much more than your own life by then.
Yes.
Was
it ever determined whether all three were dead when your grandfather left, or is it possible still that Kennedy might have been alive? Was that ever determined?
I think Kennedy was shot in the fleeing moments of the horse.
And killed?
Final shot.
So he was dead, yes.
Yeah, a final shot. Yeah.
Your grandfather must have had to have worn this sort of label of running out on his mates, and that must have played on his mind.
Yeah, it destroyed his health, actually, I think, and he left the police force some time later, you know, like it was too much to bear, I think, and I said earlier, the survivor guilt went with him to his grave.
Now, I understand he actually survived that evening in a wombat hole.
Yes, so they say that he hid in a wombat hole. And
more fluke than anything else, that apparently that wombat hole was very close actually to the Kelly hut.
Yeah.
And that wasn't by design,
that's right.
It was just by accident.
I think one of his smartest moves was unsaddling the harness wear and the saddle from the horse and having the horse flee from the area, so they would still presume that he was on the horse.
So he eventually made his way back to
Benalla. Yes, and he walked in the following Sunday, apparently, to the station and alerted the police, whoever were on there in those days.
And that would have been the first indication of the massacre.
That's right,
when he got back there.
Yeah.
Now, the story doesn't end there, does it? Because the Kelly gang are still alive. And the police are obviously not just upset, but, I mean, the pressure from the newspapers and everything else to get Ned would have been incredible. So they actually started putting resources into the area. And I believe that Ned showed a rather humorous, if that's the right word, because I remember on page 48 of that of your grandfather's story that there were three men, a Dudley, a Tennant, a McDougall, who were stopped by Ned not long after the shooting and tricked them into believing that he was actually the police, and they ended up offering him, that is Ned, to help him catch the Kellys.
All right.
Interesting sense of humour by Ned.
Did they survive?
I believe they did. And he packed them off, sent them off to look for him in a different direction.
All right.
He was also very smart, wasn't he? I believe that he actually cut the telegraph wire so that messages couldn't get sent backwards and forwards, but he knew the length of wire that the guys that repaired that carried, and he made sure he cut the wire that was longer,
extra
long, so that they couldn't repair the telegraph. So he was also a very smart man.
So that's long before wire on the note.
Yes, indeed. So he's got a sense of humour. He's not stupid. And he also had a reputation for being a gentleman. I believe that your grandfather's report indicates that he actually robbed the Euroa Bank, and that there were women and children in the bank at the time, and that he treated them very well and very courteously, and that he loaded four men, four women, and seven children into carts and buggies and actually drove them in daylight through Euroa, and that by some strange fate of chance, the men in the town had been to a funeral, and they saw this procession of carts and horses going through town and thought they were all going to a picnic, and none of them realised it was Ned. So he's certainly, you know.
Hence the name, As Bold as Ned Kelly.
As Bold as Ned Kelly.
Yeah, it was a very bold act, wasn't it?
Indeed it was. Yeah.
Of course, there probably wouldn't have been any other police in the town, or they would have been deployed somewhere else.
They would have been deployed. They were probably out looking for him.
This is Listen to Older Voices, featuring issues and information. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm speaking with Laurie Hookey, who's the great-grandson of Trooper Thomas McIntyre, the policeman who escaped the massacre at Stringybark Creek, where his three fellow police officers were killed. Laurie, calling on McIntyre's journal, is putting the police perspective to this and the subsequent events involving the Kelly Gang.
You know, to this day, there is differing opinions on whether Ned Kelly was actually a murderer or not. And again, the history through cinema seems to suggest he wasn't a murderer. He was a heroic outlaw. Yet the police reports indicate that, you know, and in fact, he shot the police in cold blood. He was a murderer. But in regard to Byrne, who was accompanied by Dan Kelly, there seems to be no doubt. But Byrne himself was a bit of a nasty piece of work, because he was accompanied by Dan when he shot a Sherritt. Is that how you pronounce it?
Aaron Sherritt.
And that Sherritt owned the hut the police were using to keep watch on Mrs. Byrne, who lived about a mile away.
Yeah.
So Byrne was a bit of a nasty piece of work.
Yeah, that took place in Beechworth on Woolshed Creek. You can go to that area. You can drive around there if you go to Beechworth, to probably where the locality was today. An informant.
He was an informant, yes. Working for the police.
He was, yeah. I think at some stage he'd been a Kelly sympathiser, and at a later stage he changed to being an informant.
Right. It must have been a little bit confusing then for all the locals, because on one hand you've got the Kellys at times assisting them, because it was periods of very hard, great hardship in that time, wasn't it?
That's right.
Not a lot of food and crops, and people were very poor, and the Kellys themselves were very poor. And the reports are that often when he'd rob a bank, he wouldn't give all the money away like Robin Hood, but he did help people out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he wasn't opposed, well, the Kelly Gang wasn't opposed to putting a bullet into somebody if they thought they were working with the police.
That's right, yeah.
So if you were a local up there, you would be watching your P's and Q's, wouldn't you, with the Kellys?
I think Kelly owed a lot of his success to the 2 years after the ambush at Stringybark Creek to sympathisers through that country all the way to Geraldary. They had a bank of people that they were able to rely on for horses and food and spend a night there or something.
He would have had to, wouldn't he? Mm. He would have had to have people helping him.
Yeah.
I believe that the death of Sherritt was that murder, was the one that led Ned to believe that police reinforcements were coming by train. from Melbourne, and that he set up to derail that train just outside Benalla.
That's right, yeah. And the, who was it? The Mr. Curnow, who was partly crippled, and he knew what was happening and he alerted the police.
He was a local schoolmaster, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So what did Ned actually take the tracks up, did he?
Pulled the tracks up. Must have pulled a section of the line out on a very steep embankment.
So it would have been a disaster if
it would have been an absolute disaster. The tree, he knew where to inflict the most problem.
Mm.
And the train would have crashed down the embankment and rolled over, you know, in some style, and the carriages would have been thrown all over the place.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, these incidents of the murder of Sherritt, the attempted derailing of the train, were actually the events that led up to the shootout at the Benalla pub with the Kelly gang. And I believe
The Glen Rowan Hotel.
No, the Benalla pub, which I believe is where the armour was first used.
All right.
So that at this stage, up till now, Ned hadn't developed his famous armour.
Yeah.
But that he used it first at Benalla.
Yeah.
Now, I understand, although the idea was brilliant, the design was actually less than brilliant. And
yeah.
That he couldn't take aim with that armour.
All right, yeah, but you need to be Arnold Schwarzenegger to wear it.
Very heavy, wasn't it? I mean, what was it made out of, do you know?
It was supposedly made out of plough shears and parts for cultivating equipment.
So, and that would have been solid.
Very, very heavy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So the idea was terrific, but he beat it all out himself, didn't he?
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
And I believe that each member of the gang had their own piece of armour.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, he's then tracked to Glen Rowan, and your grandfather said the police shot the gang's horses. Do you recall that? And if you do, why would they have shot the gang's horses? Was that so they couldn't get away?
That would be, yeah, that'd be the reason.
Right,
yeah.
So we begin...
Tethered at the hotel, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
So slowly but surely we're getting to this point of no return for Ned.
Yeah.
He's in Glen Rowan and the police are surrounding. Yeah, things are crumbling. Now, there's some very interesting quotes in your grandfather's manuscript. One says that Byrne was actually wearing his armour when he was shot in the femoral artery. Now, that has to be a lucky shot too. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the femoral artery is not, you know, at a distance, is not a big target. And apparently he was drinking a glass of whiskey and he cried out, "Oh God, I'm shot. Forgive me for my sins," and then died. Now, I guess we'll never know whether he said that. How wonderful.
Who reported to have said that?
Well, your grandfather reports that that was the report of the day, that he was shot in the femoral artery, and he said, "Oh, my God, I am shot. Forgive me for my sins," and then died on the spot. Now, I don't recall that in the movie, but my goodness me, they should have. That's a brilliant line.
And, of course, too, the police had come up, and they had a contingent of people by that time to besiege the Glen Rowan Hotel.
There was a large number, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they also had a cannon.
I didn't know that.
They had a 20-pound cannon.
Wow, they really meant
business. I know, they meant business. You know, a cannon with the big cartwheels?
Yes.
Well, not a real big one, but one that you could manoeuvre around, and they were up there to have the last shots, I think.
Goodness me. They were also using, police were also using a thing called a martini rifle at that stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, do you know much about this rifle? I believe it was quite a formidable weapon.
I think they came out of, they used them in the Crimean War. Martini, and they had a lever below the stock, and they had a sliding block mechanism on the where you pushed it down and then you inserted the bullet. They weren't repeaters, they're only a single shot.
Right. And I think this is the incident where Ned got his reputation for being invincible, because your grandfather reports that he actually took several shots in the chest. Well, of course, with that thick armour, it was going to kill him.
Yeah.
But
the shock power of the bullet slamming into the armour would be enough to knock you over.
It would be enough to knock you over.
Yeah.
But we can see that scene in our minds, can't we?
Yeah.
Coming through the mists, you know, the police shooting at him and still coming. I mean,
that's right.
It's quite an powerful image.
It is, yeah. He, by this time, imagined that he was invincible, I think.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Yeah.
Now, do you recall the incident where that police actually brought him down, how it came about?
It was supposed to have been the superintendent who shot him in the legs with buckshot.
Yes.
And it was obvious way to go, wasn't it? Because he was protected from the the head to his groin virtually, but the rest of him was exposed. So that was obviously the way to shoot him, was to bring him down, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, someone had used their brains.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I believe they brought him down into a half-sitting position where he was actually resting against logs.
Yeah.
There's a name that Australia will never forget. The best-known Australian I'd sure like to bet. Though granted its owner dishonoured his name, yet one thing is certain, Ned Kelly was game. Game as Ned Kelly, the people would say. Game as Ned Kelly, they say it today. Oh, great was their fame when the Kelly boys rode those daring bush rangers with no fixed abode. They laughed at the lore, a big price on their head. The troopers could never catch up with Wild Ned. Game as Ned Kelly, the people would say. Game as Ned Kelly, they say it today. They stuck up the stations but never were caught. But everyone reckoned that Ned was a sport. They captured a township, those bush rangers bold. Then off to the ranges they rode with the gold. Game as Ned Kelly, the people would say. Game as Ned Kelly, they say it today. But at last at Glenrowan the Kelly gang fell, while fighting for life from the burning hotel. When out came Ned Kelly, still blazing away, till wounded by troopers he fell in the fray. Game as Ned Kelly, the people would say. Game as Ned Kelly, they say it today. So to the gallows the outlaw was led. Now die like a Kelly, his mother had said. A faint such as life, the bold bush ranger sighed. The trapdoor sprang open and Ned Kelly died. Game as Ned Kelly, the people would say. Game as Ned Kelly, they say it today.
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time.
Very dramatic moment, though, isn't it? Because Kelly's been basically captured and shot in the legs. Now, the others are in the Glenrowan Hotel, and the police set it on fire.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, that's no small event, is it?
No.
Burning of the Glenrowan Hotel with the Kellys in there.
That's right, and also a lot of other innocent hostages in there too.
That's right.
Mm.
Do any of them escape or are they killed?
As I recall, those hostages lost their lives there too.
Yeah.
Mm.
What I found quite stunning and amazing was that they actually found the bodies of Dan and Hart side by side, apparently with their armour off.
Yeah.
With bags under their heads, and that they committed suicide.
Yeah, I don't know if that would be right.
Do you want to grab the manuscript?
Mary Rose went and located the manuscript, and when she came back, she started talking about the circumstances under which McIntyre had written it, when he had apparently fallen ill.
And during his time in hospital, what he'd done was there was 2 years between the massacre at Stringy Bark Farm and the shootout at
Stringy Bark Creek, not
Stringy Bark Creek, sorry. And in the meantime, he obviously immediately after all this, he wrote up all his evidence. He actually had bits of, he was a shorthand expert.
Oh,
and he'd right. written bits of information on bits of paper in shorthand. That Laurie's father did have, but Silverfish ate it, and that, to me, that was the most important thing of the lot.
A lot of that would have been transcribed from shorthand notes.
So he then put all that together. But then also, after Kelly was captured, and then McIntyre knew it was going to go to trial and all that sort of thing, in the meantime, during his convalescence, he'd saved he had, and we actually saw it at this ambush thing at the police museum. He had two, what do you call them, books where every single item about or editorial about the Kellys, he'd actually put it all together in these books.
He had scrapbooks and
scrapbooks, yeah.
Scrapbooks, and he had
all
articles
that as
from
well.
The papers.
Yeah. So he had all of that. And so I'm trying to find this Sajasura of Wangaratta, Daddle Barrel.
He wanders off on these things a bit, but it's, when you're reading, it's sort of he goes, he's a bit like the two Ronnies or something, you know. Like you tell a story
and
it goes about.
And the body of Byrne were removed.
That's getting very close because we're talking about.
We want before then, don't we?
Dan and Hart.
I believe that they were that badly charred. They brought them out on corrugated iron of the roof of the building or something.
Well, if we find the section, we might actually read that bit.
Mm.
But I know it's in there.
I don't know if I read that in there, though, but McIntyre wasn't there, I don't think, when
no.
at Glen Rowan.
No.
He was back in Melbourne. He was
Seal.
Yeah.
So we've got two of the Kelly gang committing suicide. Mary, I think you found the section in the book there where it talks about it. Would you like to read it?
Yes, I certainly would. And it's very interesting, and it's the evidence initially given by the local Catholic priest, Father Gibney. And obviously he was there because some of the Kellys, as we all know, were Catholic. Father Gibney, in this document it says, was prevented from going up to the hotel immediately, and it was a considerable time before the burning of the hotel actually took place. But when the flames burst through the house, he saw that if the outlaws were not already dead, death was hovering around the building. And recognising it was his duty, in other words, his religious duty, he walked boldly up and entered the building. He searched some rooms before he found any of them. When he came upon the body of Byrne, it was lying as he had fallen, and the body was quite cold and stiff. In a small room at the back of the house, he found the bodies of the two other bushrangers. They were both lying side by side, their armour off, and alongside each body, they had each of them a bag rolled up and placed under their head. They looked composed as if they were asleep. Father Gibney examined their eyes, which satisfied him they had been dead for some time. In his opinion, from their plainly pre-arranged position, they had committed suicide.
Next week is the third and final part of our special story. Not only do we finalise this tale, we look at and discuss the fallout for the families. We learn as to whether the families have developed any sort of relationship when they came together a few years ago. And we'll hear a poem written by McIntyre about the death of Sergeant Kennedy at Stringy Bark Creek. So join Laurie, Mary and myself next week on Listen to Older Voices.
Four jolly troopers from Mansfield town set out to hunt all them Kelly boys down. They searched through the Wombat for most of the week, and they camped on the banks of the Stringy Bark Creek. But Lonergan's widow, she's singing no songs. She walks these red hills and she cries all night long. They say that Ned Kelly ain't never done wrong. Tell that to Lonergan's widow. Early that morning, mid laughter and shouting, Kennedy and Scanlon, they rode off a scout and left McIntyre to cook up the grub while Lonergan sang at the old washing tub. They were cleaning the camp, boiling some tea, when up jumped Ned Kelly with his comrades three. A shout and a cry and the crack of a gun. Lonergan staggers, and Lonergan's done. But Lonergan's widow, she's singing low songs. She walks these red hills and she cries all night long. They say that Ned Kelly ain't never done wrong, but tell that to Lonergan's widow.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.